Good morning. I'm so excited about our passage today. It's one of my favorite passages, and I guess it might not be a surprise to you that since it's one of my favorites, it was not included in the lectionary. So you don't hear this story read if churches are following the lectionary. They skip over this whole story. So we're going to hear a story from Acts this morning. And just as by way of background, just share with you a little bit about Acts. Acts was written by someone who wrote another book of the Bible. Do you remember? Anybody? Teacher's pets? What? Luke, that's right. So the same author that wrote the Gospel according to Luke also wrote the Acts of the Apostles. Okay, so, and you can see they just flow right into one another. The same writing style, the same everything, and it's clear. He even says right at the very beginning, I wrote that other book, and I'm writing this one just to clarify a few things. So, the book of Acts is dealing with the development of the earliest of the Christian movement. The majority of the story is about Paul. Paul is definitely the star of the book of Acts, but if you're a student of Acts, you're going to discover that most of Luke's stories about Paul conflict with Paul's own writing about Paul. In other words, the stories that Paul tells in Acts about, or that Luke tells about Paul in Acts, couldn't possibly have happened if you take Paul's authentic letters seriously. So we're hard-pressed to take what Luke writes as absolutely authoritative historically. So I just toss that out to you right now as we consider reading a passage from Acts, because Luke is wanting to tell these different stories about the early church, and the way he did it was in ways that didn't necessarily fit with what actually happened, but what he wanted to give out to people as a challenge for living their lives as Christians. And so what we have today is a story about Peter. Now, Peter, remember, is in with Jesus' brother, James. And Peter and James are the leaders of what's called the Jerusalem church. After Jesus' death, the running of the movement went to Jesus' brother, James, right? So the closest relative took over for Jesus. And it went to Jesus' right-hand man, Peter. So James and Peter were kind of running things in Jerusalem. But their idea was that it was more of a Jewish renewal movement. In their minds, you have to be a good Jew before you can be a Christian. And so you got to be circumcised, which for adult Gentile men wasn't the best marketing campaign in the world. You got to keep kosher, which for the women who were mostly responsible for keeping that wasn't very popular with them. So Paul opposed them directly. He even says in Galatians or someplace, I opposed Peter to his face, you know, because they had this difference of opinion on how the early church was going to go. So although he's not mentioned directly, this story is still kind of about Paul. Peter is so hard-headed and is not listening to Paul that this story has God stepping in and taking Paul's side and making Paul's point for him, basically saying to Peter, who do you think you are? Who are you to say someone isn't worthy of God's grace? And so that's where we pick up our story today, is Peter getting bonked over the head with something that he is resisting over and over again. Does that sound like Peter? All right. Oh, hang on a second. Before we read it, I just have to say something. This is from Eugene Peterson's The Message version, right? And we use The Message a lot because it's very easy reading, gets across the message. Well, it just so happens that Phil and Pat Iverson live not too far from Eugene Peterson up in Montana. And so Phil being Phil, those of you that are here regularly know Phil usually sits right there. Phil being Phil called up Eugene Peterson and said, hey, we use your book in church all the time. And so he sent me this picture this week. He went over and met Eugene Peterson. So leave it to Phil, you know, and so I'm just here to tell you, if you want to meet somebody and you think they're inaccessible, just call them. It's great. They had a great conversation, and Phil is so excited he can hardly contain himself. So anyway, so now we're going to listen to this gentleman's version of Acts 10.
There was a man named Cornelius who lived in Caesarea, captain of the Italian guard stationed there. He was a thoroughly good man. He had led everyone in his house to live worshipfully before God, always helping people in need, and had the habit of prayer. One day, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he had a vision. The angel of God, as real as his next-door neighbor, came in and said, Cornelius. Cornelius stared hard, wondering if he were seeing things. And then he said, what do you want, sir? The angel said, your prayers and neighborly acts have brought you to God's attention. Here's what you are to do. Send men to Joppa to get Simon, the one everyone calls Peter. He's staying with Simon the Tanner, whose house is down by the sea. As soon as the angel was gone, Cornelius called 2 servants and 1 particularly devout soldier from the guard. He went over with them in great detail everything that had just happened and then sent them off to Joppa. The next day, as the 3 travelers were approaching the town, Peter went out on the balcony to pray. It was about noon. Peter got hungry and started thinking about lunch. While lunch was being prepared, he fell into a trance. He saw the skies open up. Something that looked like a huge blanket, lowered by ropes at its 4 corners, settled on the ground. Every kind of animal and reptile and bird you could think of was on it. Then a voice came. Go to it, Peter. Kill and eat and eat. Peter said, no, no, Lord. I've never so much as tasted food that was not kosher. The voice came a second time. If God says it's okay, it's okay. This happened 3 times, and the blanket was pulled back into the skies. As Peter, puzzled, sat there trying to figure out what it all meant, the men sent by Cornelius showed up at Simon's front door. They called in, asking if there was a Simon, also called Peter, staying there. Peter, lost in thought, didn't hear them. So the Spirit whispered to him, 3 men are knocking on the door looking for you. Get down there and go with them. Don't ask any questions. I sent them to get you. Peter went down and said to the men, I think I'm the man you're looking for. What's up? They said, Captain Cornelius, a God-fearing man well known in this fair play, asked any Jew in this part of the country, as commanded by a holy angel, to get you and bring you to his house so he could hear what you had to say. Peter invited them in and made them feel at home. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, we give thanks for these words of wisdom, this story that comes to us from so long ago, that continues to challenge us in the way we would seek to be followers of Jesus. May your Spirit be upon us as we consider them for our lives this day, so that none of us might leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. When I lived in Boston, this is where you would find me on most Fridays. Pretty impressive pile of rocks, huh? It's Trinity Church, Copley Square. You might have caught a glimpse of it during the Boston bombing coverage because the finish line was right there at Copley Square with Trinity Church right there. Any architectural students know about this building? It's called Richardsonian Romanesque, right? You knew that. And to this day, it's on the American Institute of Architects list as one of the 10 most significant buildings in the United States. It is an amazing piece of work, And every Friday they would offer free concerts at noon over the lunch hour. And so I would go downtown Boston from my place, and I would get rush tickets to the Boston Symphony Orchestra, which were just $6 for students. And so I'd go down and hear, get the rush tickets first, then I'd go to the church and hear an organ concert or something else. And then by that time, it was time to walk up Huntington Avenue to the Symphony Hall and hear the symphony. I mean, Boston is just that kind of place, you know, where if you're looking for that, you can just bathe in just this amazing culture. The rector who directed the building of the church in the 1870s is depicted here in a statue outside the church. Phillips Brooks. Now, Phillips Brooks, and you're looking at that, and I've always, you see how Jesus has his hand on Phillips' shoulder? I've always had the impression that Jesus is kind of holding him back a bit, going, whoa, hold on there, brother. You know? But he was renowned. He's still so popular that he's been canonized by the Episcopal Church. He was a priest, he was a poet, he was an author, he was a preacher, and he's probably best known to most of you here today as having written the lyrics to one of everybody's favorite Christmas carols. You know which one? O Little Town of Bethlehem was written by Phillips Brooks. Now, my professor, Harold Beck, was intrigued by Brooks, and he instilled in me a fascination for Phillips Brooks. And so I thought I'd take a few weeks here to share with you some classic Brooks, updated a bit. You know, he looks like a pretty severe person there, you know, classic kind of 19th century preacher. But he was an outspoken opponent of slavery. He was a proponent of education. He was a champion of reason. He was the Bishop of Massachusetts. But most importantly, in a way that is really hard for us to go back 125 years and really grasp, is that he was a Victorian-era rock star. I mean, everybody knew who Phillips Brooks was. And so one of the stories that Harold used to tell about Phillips Brooks was like this. Phillips Brooks said that we're lucky as clergy if we have one sermon. After that, most clergy just rearrange the texts. And I think that's true. My hat's off to Phillips Brooks. He spent 30 years in one church. I have no idea how one person could do it, even with Episcopalians. One Sunday, Brooks did his best, and a visitor in the parish said to one of the members of Trinity Church, "My, that was a great sermon by Dr. Brooks." To which the member of the church said, "Glad you liked it. We like it every time we hear it." The village idiot was also in attendance at church that day and sidled over to Dr. Brooks about three or four times to tell him how lousy the sermon was. And an usher who was noticing that Dr. Brooks was a little disturbed finally went up to Dr. Brooks and said, "Don't pay any attention to that fellow. He only repeats what he hears other people saying." Our Acts passage today is essentially a wake-up call for Peter. It's saying, hey, what God has called holy, who are you to call unholy? And it happens how many times? Three times, right? Does that sound familiar? Because Peter is so dense. Peter and James think they've got it all figured out. Paul is the outlier here. Paul is the one that's not following the rules. He's hanging out with Gentiles. He's welcoming the unclean into their exclusive little club. Peter and James have got a lock on the power in the Jerusalem church. But little do they know what we know now and what the author of Acts knows all too well, that in 70 of the Common Era, the Romans were going to come in and completely destroy Jerusalem, and with it, the so-called Jerusalem church. The temple's destroyed, the Sadducees, they evaporate, the whole sacrificial system disappears, but the fledgling Christian church in Jerusalem disappears as well. And with it, Peter and James' leadership. So, people who first heard this story must have been thinking to themselves, come on, Peter, I mean, you better choose the right horse here, because you know what's going to happen in a few years, and so you need to get out there with the Gentiles, because what you think is the best bet is going to be destroyed here in a couple of years, and it's going to be gone. And so it's going to be obsolete. And so you need to go with the Gentiles, and you need to get over yourself. Peter had been sitting on the top of Simon's house at Jaffa, Simon was a tanner. You know what a tanner is? Leather maker, right? So there's all sorts of unusual smells associated with being a tanner, being a leather maker. And his house was isolated. It was down by the water, far away from town. And that's something to keep in mind when you're considering Peter's mindset in this story. A tanner was constantly dealing with dead animals, an occupation that was regarded with aversion by the most observant of Jews, because it necessitated more or less perpetual ceremonial uncleanliness. You were always contaminated, right? And so it says something that Peter was willing to dwell with a tanner in the first place, that reveals that he, unlike other observant Jews, was already open to kind of fudging a little bit, to altering his views on the ceremonial laws. Now, he'd seen this great vision and heard the voice speak to him, and he was still just sitting there. Did you notice in the passage? He's sitting there thinking. I mean, even though it happened three times, he was still wondering about what it was meaning, right? It couldn't possibly mean what he thought it meant. I think he was sitting there trying to talk himself out of it. And that's when he heard these footsteps down below. And the Spirit whispered to him and said, hey, there are three guys downstairs. Go down there. Check it out. Right? And they were Gentiles. And by definition, they were unclean. And their arrival gave Peter the opportunity to either ignore or put into action the idea that had possessed him in this vision, and that not even the voice of God really could convince him of, right? Because he still wasn't doing anything. So here he is. He's standing between this vision and the application of the vision. He's stuck. He's not doing anything. And I think he said, if I don't respond, then that missed opportunity might just deaden me to the call on my life. Brooks says that if I do respond, then I'll be going against everything that I've embraced and practiced all my life. It's a place where, if we're paying attention, most of us find ourselves many times in life just stuck. I'm not sure if I have the courage to go on, and maybe it's just safer just to ignore whatever that vision is and just sit here. Thank you very much. We have a tendency to stand sometimes catatonic between what we think are concrete facts on one side and an abstract idea on the other. Brooks says, we stand between knowing and loving. Knowing is critical to a life lived with responsibility, with wisdom, and often wisdom born of experience, sometimes not so happy experience. But it's in the loving that we become complete or whole. We see it over and over again in the life of Jesus. He was, as Brooks put it, no rapt, self-centered student of the abstract, nor was he the merely ready, sentimental pitier of the woes of men. Sounds very 19th century, doesn't it? Jesus combined vision and action and didn't get stuck between the two. Brooks tells the story of knowing people who were good enough folks, but they were people who were simply kind of going through the motions of life, just kind of getting by. And then one day, encountering one of these someones, he found them to be profoundly changed. someone who was much warmer, richer, more tender, almost radiant. And the difference was, as they fell into conversation, that they had just passed through an overwhelming sorrow, or they had stood on the brink of some tremendous danger, or they'd spent day and night in the deep darkness of bewildering anxiety. And Brooks asks, who goes worthily through sorrow or anxiety and does not come out hating shams and pretenses, hungering instead for truth? Not only that, but full of sympathy for other people with whom he or she can now relate. If this is the case, then aren't our encounters with the really terrible experiences of life sometimes redeemable? Brooks was known to have said, character may be manifested in the great moments, but it is made in the small ones. It's made in the small ones. About 20 years ago, a member of the youth group at the church I was serving, she was just 15, had a seizure in her tub, and she nearly drowned. Her mother discovered her. They called 911, rushed her to the hospital, but it was too late. She was brain dead. And since she was on a ventilator, the decision had to be made as to when to take her off the machine and let her go. Now, as I stood there with the family, preparing for that inevitability, for that moment, I was both stupefied and angry by what Brooks calls those shams and pretenses I heard coming out of people's mouths. People trying to comfort the family and themselves by saying things like, God needed her in heaven more than you need her here. Oh, thank you. Or things that were variations on that, like, God needed another angel in heaven. Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad God is so needy, right? People were grasping at reasons. God's will? No. God doesn't plan these things. Punishment? Well, only the most heartless would say such a thing. A warning? Only an unbelievable narcissist would say such a thing. Such a tragedy, and you know what? It's all about me, right? It's warning me. It's a test, somebody said. Of whom? Of her parents? What kind of God would test people by killing their children? That whole argument is at the center of the story of Job in the Bible. And Job ends up cursing God. They were well-meaning people with really stupid ideas. And that experience prepared me and others who were there to clarify our responses to such tragedies so we would never let such comments stand again without challenge and saying, no, that's not the way it works. I heard a rabbi say that Jews are retroactive meaning makers. Retroactive meaning makers. Events take on meaning only insofar as they change us to respond with compassion. Likewise, Brooks says, there are special visions which, through the soul that is prepared, become transformed into influence and blessings on humanity. We can be transformed through these experiences. Brooks says there is a danger of selfishness in our religion. It makes people say, I'm content, for I have seen the Lord, and the great host of other human beings in need are nothing. Another might say, what business is it of anyone if I simply close my eyes to the vision? Who has a right to interfere or urge me? To the first, he says, just sitting back, just keeping your faith solely to yourself, will certainly decay. And I love what he writes here. I could just hear him standing in the pulpit saying, up, up and go! I mean, it sounds like a superhero. But he says, get out there. Find those who are in need and to whom you can be as Christ, who you can reach out to sometime in a way that is totally unique to you, that no one else can do. To the other, he says, the window which makes itself dark darkens not merely itself, but also all the room into which the light might have shone through it. So our challenge is to open ourselves to the presence of the divine in every aspect of our lives and realize that Christ is within us. Whenever we bracket out times to be spiritual and other times to not be spiritual, we are at the risk of missing some of the most powerful moments in our lives. So in our passage today, Peter had to be disavowed of the notion that eating religious foods made him holy. Right? That's what he thought. And all of us need to be disavowed of similar prejudices and ruts in our spiritual lives. If you're skeptical, don't worry. Remember, God had to even tell Peter how many times? Three times. So you might be in for some, you know, knocking here. Brooks says, it's a terrible thing to have seen the vision and to be so wrapped up in its contemplation as to not hear the knock of needy hands upon your door. Right? It goes back to that old saying, people are so heavenly minded, they're not, no earthly good, right? Likewise, and I love this finishing up, he says, it's a terrible thing to hear the knock and have no vision to declare to the knocker. Right? So it goes both ways. I mean, you got to be ready. So the point today is that the Spirit won't be contained. The Spirit of God is loose in the world and being expressed in all sorts of experiences. It's impossible to keep your spiritual life and your regular life that you have outside of church separate. And people try their whole lives. You can try. But the divine is always knocking on your door, calling you to respond out of your experiences, your vision, for a richer, more compassionate world. All of life can be used by God. And our challenge is to not get stuck between that vision and our action or lack of action. It's about integrating every part of life, about recognizing that the Spirit is at work in everything from the most mundane circumstances to the most miserable of circumstances. And so our stream of thought today is another quote by Phillips Brooks. Do not pray for tasks equal to your powers. Pray for powers equal to your tasks. Amen? I mean, that is huge. Laura said it sounds like a Stephen Covey quote, but do not pray for tasks equal to your powers. Pray for powers equal to your tasks. You know, I had a car a number of years ago that had a carburetor. Do you remember those? Cars with carburetors. And one of the things that used to happen regularly that I think is a good mechanical metaphor for what we're talking about today, vapor lock, right? Do you remember vapor lock? I would turn off my car, but it would not stop. And it wasn't really going either. Can anyone imitate the sound? Yeah, okay, we've got some experience here in the room. It would stop. It wouldn't stop and it wouldn't go. It was just kind of stuck there, and you know, you'd have to get in there and oh my gosh, it was a mess. And I think that's where Peter was when the knock came on his door. There was just too much to comprehend going ahead, and there was too much to comprehend staying still, and he was stuck. And so the question I leave you with today is, are you stuck in vapor lock? In between the vision and the action? Or are we letting the two build on one another until we're using both the best and worst experiences of our lives to enrich the lives of others. Jesus showed us the way. Peter, after considerable nudging, finally got it. So what vision and action are you stuck between? Does it seem too big? Does it seem too impractical? Counter to your old ways? Let me finish with this Phillips Brooks quote. Sad will be the day for anyone when they become contented with the thoughts they are thinking and the deeds they are doing, where there is not forever beating at the doors of their soul some great desire to do something larger, which they know they were meant and made to do. Amen? Let's get out there and knock some doors, all right?